Welcome back to another episode of Exploring the Arts. I am Joel Thiel.
And I'm Ian McMillan.
And today we are here with Dr. Joe Rigney. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Awesome. Let's get started. Who are you at NSA? What do you do? What do you teach?
I am a fellow of theology, which at the moment means that I mainly teach our lordship class for the freshmen. So I have about half the students and Dr. Longshore has the other half. And then I'm teaching various and sundry electives here and there. So last fall I taught a Shakespeare elective. And hopefully in the coming year, right now I'm splitting time between NSA and Christchurch. And we'll probably ramp up a little bit on the NSA side going forward.
Awesome. And could you kind of walk us through the curriculum of the Lordship program, kind of how it differs from Dr. Longshore's, what you're, you know, hoping that the students will get out of?
Yeah. So I would say that my version of the Lordship course is, you know, in comparison to Dr. Longshore's, is mine's the awesome version.
And his As opposed to the lame version.
His is the sort of cool version.
Sort of cool. Okay. Sort of cool and then awesome.
But mine's the awesome one. No. So the basic structure is pretty similar, actually. And he and I work together a lot on trying to sketch that course out. So it's four terms. We start with sort of doctrine of God, creation. For me, that means spending a lot of time, Genesis 1 to 4, 1 to 11, somewhere in there. Just getting, you know, who is God? What is humanity? What is sin? What's the problem? That sort of stuff. So we spend a lot of time there. That's book one of Calvin. So we still read through Calvin's Institutes over the year.
Nice.
In the second term, we spend a good bit of time on the doctrine, a kind of biblical theology, kind of running through the Bible. So some covenant stuff, as well as the Gospels, who is Christ, life, death, that sort of stuff. So we ended the second term this time with the cross, and then picked up right there with the resurrection at the beginning of the third term. And then that was kind of a lead into the doctrine of salvation. So we talked about Reformed theology, doctrines of grace, and then really got into the Christian life. So, already not yet. So we're already saved, but not yet saved. How does that all work? Justification, these sort of questions. And then got into the doctrine of the Christian life, where we've been talking about some C.S. Lewis stuff and Mortification of Sin by John Owen. So that's been kind of the main text. And then in the final term, we'll get to, doctrine of the church, state, postmillennialism, eschatology, all that kind of thing. Manhood, womanhood, kind of on the more practical side, like, sacraments. So that's kind of the rough and ready. It kind of does a little bit of it's a mixture, I would say, of biblical theology, systematic theology, and sort of Moscow cultural distinctives, what makes us unique among other Christians. So that's kind of the package that we're trying to impart to the freshmen, lay a good foundation.
So yeah, you said it's biblical theology and systematic theology. What are some of the other branches of theology, and what are their, you know, benefits, distinctives as well?
Yeah. So when I say biblical theology, that's basically seeing how the Bible unfolds over time, so Genesis through Revelation, as it unfolds through covenants, through the history of redemption. Systematic theology is more of the, what does the whole Bible say about, where you're not as concerned about the unfolding, but sort of just the end result. So that's what I mean by those two. We do practical theology. So, you know, talking about prayer, we could, you know, there's other ethics would kind of be a maybe its own branch of theology in some ways. And so we talk some about that. But those would be some of the other, you know, branches that we talk about. And my main goal a lot of times is walk through texts. I want students to be able to see, here's our doctrinal conclusions. In fact, frequently I'll say, here's the answer. Right. Now the rest of the class is going to be showing the work. So walking through the text, do you see for yourself what the Bible has to say about whatever it is we're talking about?
That's awesome. So I guess maybe on the practical theology side too, I heard that you guys in your class did Religious Affections by Edwards. Could you walk us through and just tell us about that and why? I mean, that's one of my favorite books.
Yeah.
So tell us about that and the purpose for your class.
For that one, we mainly only did actually the first part of it. We didn't even get through the rest of it. But the main goal was to kind of introduce this notion of the faculty psychology. Like, what are we as human beings? Like, we have a mind, we have a heart, we have an intellect, a will. What are the terms we should use for that? And so we used Edwards as one sort of entry point in, and then basically I kind of used Edwards as the entry point and then complicated things by thinking in terms of, you know, there's sort of certain acts of the will that are, you know, more I don't know, fundamental, deeper, longstanding, permanent. And then there's sort of the passions, which are often more instinctive, impulsive. And so how do we think about tiered psychology, things like that? So that's fun. And we've come back to that again and again, because it really is a really helpful way to think about the fight against sin, about temptations that we face. And so getting sort of the right map of yourself, is a really helpful thing as you're trying to follow Christ.
Totally. Yeah. And I can totally see how that kind of combined, or maybe as the preface to then going into like mortification of sin and some of these other things can be super helpful.
Yeah, exactly. And kind of on that note, a lot of people, especially nowadays, they like, you know, there's certain like personal psychology, you know, personality tests, all that stuff. What do you think, what do you think about those? Yeah, exactly. What do you think about those kind of...
It's the Enneagram, man.
Zodiac signs.
Yeah, exactly. So I, when it comes to personality tests, I tend to be of the camp that thinks if we treat these as sort of rough and ready wisdom tools, then they're fine. So in other words, they can shed insight on sort of how you tick, what your, you know, tendencies are, where your weaknesses are. Yeah. I found various ones helpful over the years. You know, in sort of illuminating different aspects of kind of natural bents, strengths and weaknesses. The problem, so personality test as wisdom tradition or something like that works. personality test as gospel truth, deepest part of me, is stupid and you just don't do it. Yeah. And so I get nervous when it kind of gets elevated, because then often it becomes excuse making. It's a way of, basically I don't have to change because I'm an Enneagram, you know, 5-wing 6. And so that means that, that's just a part of who I am and I don't need to change, or I'm an INTJ and therefore I don't need to do X. Yeah. And so it becomes an excuse to avoid, your duties as a Christian rather than an illuminating tool to sort of help you see weaknesses and strengths.
Right. And how, like with, it's just kind of a random question, but like psychologists who aren't looking at everything from a biblical worldview, like how helpful is it when it's detached from the gospel and Christ? And then where does it kind of, where do you think it kind of gets into trouble?
Yeah. So, it could definitely be a problem. But one of the, you know, the paradigm for a lot of these things is, you know, plunder the Egyptians. So, oftentimes, even secular psychologists can, when they're trying to do good work, which they aren't always, sometimes they're trying to shoehorn things, but when they're actually attentive to reality, can make observations that Christians can appropriate and pull into a better framework that explains them. Mm-hmm. So I've often read, non-Christian, even psychology is a good example, that have sort of pinpointed, here's real issues in reality. There's phenomenon. And then oftentimes their explanatory story for that phenomenon is deeply flawed. It's evolutionary gobbledygook. And so their story is wrong, but the data that they're pointing out that we ought to account for is right. And so, and sometimes they can even come up with constructs that are helpful. So an example of one of those is, Jonathan Haidt, who's written a number of different books. The Righteous Mind is probably the one he's known for the most, uses this image of like a rider and an elephant to talk about tiered psychology, where sort of you have your intellect and your will, your executive functioning is the psychological term. And then you've got kind of your lower level animal self, with the elephant is what he calls that, which is where the passions and the sort of the intuitions and the impulses lie. And, his whole point is, the rider ought to be in charge, but the elephant is really strong. And so your elephant often can just sort of want to do stuff. And then the rider becomes the defense attorney for the elephant, just excusing whatever it just did. Mm-hmm. So you're just doing what you want, and then you're rationalizing it on the back end. And that's actually a pretty good observation about how sinful human beings operate. Yeah. And so to sort of fold that into a more Christian psychology, where you're thinking about the mind and the body, where you're thinking about the intellect and will on the one hand and the passions on the other hand. And then, you know, sort of the Romans 6:7-8, the tensions there, in the divided man, all of those things, when you sort of have that rider and elephant category, it's a really sticky way to unpack some of those biblical terms.
Well, Joel, that was a very good question to segue into the book that you're presently writing for, Canon.
Yeah.
That's also about psychology, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So Leadership and Emotional Sabotage. And it comes
shameless
out.
Plug,
shameless plug. You should all go pre-order it and buy a million copies. So that comes out in a week or so, be shipping. And that's actually a good example of, you know, Edwin Friedman was a Jewish rabbi in the 90s who wrote a book on leadership that I found helpful, but it's the sort of book that you have to plunder. You plunder the Egyptians to build the house of God.
Yeah.
And so, he's really astute when it comes to observing trends, but he's got a janky theology and an evolutionary story that then helps him make sense of it and is really kind of just not helpful. Yeah. And so I'd love to give that. I've recommended that book to people, his book, but it's always with caveats and, you know, qualifications. You just ignore that. And some people can't get past it. All they see is that. And so all the good gets lost because of all the junk. And so part of what I was doing in the new book is sort of taking the best of Friedman's insights and trying to root them in more biblical soil, using biblical language, biblical categories to say, these actually are really problems. And the Bible actually addresses them in some really profound ways.
Mm. You've also written articles on, well, maybe an article on empathy and how Christians can.
I've written probably 40,000 words on empathy in the last like 6 years.
Tell us about empathy.
Yeah.
Well, like, is it a sin, Dr.
Yes. Yes. No, yeah. I'm a heartless fool. No. empathy. Here's the deal. One of the major lessons I've learned from C.S. Lewis is that the greater the good that something is, a natural good, the more gnarly it gets when it goes wrong. So, Lewis loves to dramatize this, like in Great Divorce, where mother love, is a great good. It's a glorious good. The Victorians loved it. And here's this awesome thing called mother love and mother affection and all of the things it does.
Yeah.
But when it becomes a God, when it becomes the highest thing, it becomes a demon and it's really bad. Similarly, compassion, sympathy, is a great Christian virtue. It's a glorious and good thing. It's, weeping with those who weep. It spurs you to action to help those who are suffering and hurting. And in that sense, is a great and glorious thing. Therefore, when it goes wrong, when it gets set up as a God, it goes really bad. And the modern virtue, if you can call it that, of empathy is that thing. It's compassion gone wrong. It's compassion because it's gone untethered. So when I use empathy, there's a way to use that term that's fine. And I'm not going to word fuss with people. But oftentimes it's untethered from what's true, what's good, and is more oriented toward the immediate feelings of someone and therefore requires validation. Whatever someone feels, you need to validate it, affirm it, endorse it. And if you don't, you're not loving them. You're not, empathizing with them. And then in that context, empathy becomes a steering wheel where people use it in order to manipulate, to blackmail. And all of us have had experiences of this. Most of us have done this at some level to people where you throw a pity party in order to get your way. You sulk in order to get your way. This is something else that Lewis is really helpful on. So I learned it from Lewis before I learned it from Friedman. But it's a perennial problem and one that I decided to wade into about 6 or 7 years ago publicly. And then everybody decided to prove my point.
Exactly. that you're heartless, right?
That I'm heartless, right?
That's the point.
And I joke about that a little bit, but like there's a way in which like compassion is too important of a thing to entrust to people who are untethered from reality, right? Like it's so like, it's not, I'm actually really trying to guard compassion. Abuse is so awful that you can't entrust it to the empathetic.
Totally.
It's so horrific. Like real abuse is so bad that you don't want to trust it to people who are going to use it, to flop over small things and exaggerate and sort of debase that term by you said something mean to me one time and therefore you're an abuser. And it's like, no, there's actually that word is a big word. Don't debase the currency that way. And so part of what I've been trying to do in this whole thing, which I keep doing, despite the advice of friends sometimes, right? Like, do you really want to be that guy? So, yes, I do. Because this is actually where the fight is. This is where one of the big battles in our culture is, is over, is God God or are feelings God? Is the supremacy of God over feelings or the feelings are supreme and we need to follow them wherever they lead.
For sure.
And so wading into it again and again is an insistence that we're not going to be steered that way. Instead, we're going to tether ourselves to Jesus. We're going to have bowels of compassion, deep feeling, deep emotion, weeping with those who weep, rejoicing with those who rejoice. And because of that, we're going to reserve the right not to blaspheme. We're not going to go where they want. We're not going to coddle the things that shouldn't be coddled. We're not going to concede the things that shouldn't be conceded because we're tethered to something more fundamental than the people's feelings.
Yeah. Right? And so I guess on that, maybe connecting it more explicitly to the Friedman book, like what, so would you say like the Christian basis for, I mean, being self-differentiated as he calls it is, being tethered to Jesus such that you're not kind of pulled around by.
So the way I talk about it is, what Friedman calls self-differentiation, which is his psychological term for it. This is like the translation deal is the Bible term is sober-mindedness. Okay. So sober-mindedness means you're not drunk on other people's passions. You're not, there's a difference between you and them, and you're not just sort of drug along. Mm-hmm. And where does sober-mindedness, biblical sober-mindedness come from? Well, it comes from Christ, gravity and gladness in Christ. So gravity, because you fear the Lord. And so that gives you weight, and therefore you're stable, steadfast, unsteerable. But you're not scowling. It's gladness. It's a happy thing. So you're rejoicing in God. And so your joy in God gives you gravity, gives you gladness, and therefore you're not steered by the passions of the world.
Yeah. And so you've, on top of writing a lot of articles for different publications, you've also written a number of books. Mm-hmm. Just kind of wanting to ask you, like, what is your kind of thought process, like, while you're writing this, or when you have an idea, like, I have all these thoughts on this certain topic, like empathy. What is your thought process? Like, is this a relevant thing for me to, you know, write something about and put out?
Yeah.
Is it necessary for me, for people to hear this?
Yeah. How do you think about engaging the culture?
Exactly.
Yeah.
That we're all about here in Moscow.
I would say, so when it comes to books, I usually have like a hopper, like there's like a whole slew of them kind of in the background that are just kind of always churning. And it's when the time seems right, when it rises, when it sort of gets to the point where, I got to get this out or I'm going to burst.
Yeah.
That's how books have worked. And so whether it's Things of Earth, whether it's, so that, that was just, that book was, bridging the gap between sort of, from Bethlehem, College and Seminary, John Piper, and all the influence he's had on me, and Doug, and the influence he's had on me, Jonathan Edwards and C.S. Lewis, like all of these influences just sort of like boiling, and eventually it's going to come out. So that's what Things of Earth was. And then Strangely Bright, which is the little cousin for that book, was basically the book for those who liked Things of Earth. This is the book you can give to your mom.
Yeah.
Because she's not going to read a big book that opens with the chapter on the Trinity and then continues with the chapter on Calvinism and the
very
sovereignty
dense
of God.
Theology.
Really and, dense theology. And your mom's going to go, I don't like this, but you're like, she really needs to get it. And so it's like, here's Strangely Bright, which is just the little cousin.
Yep.
Other books have been more practical needs. So, More Than a Battle, which is my book on sexual sin, sort of emerged out of just ministry, seeing guys, this is a rampant issue with pornography, and, finding that no book that I could recommend really tackled it in the way I would basically piecemeal it.
Yeah.
Sort of this from over here, this from over here, this from over here. And so, I'd done that enough that I had done some teaching on it. People had gone back to those and said, hey, can we get more of that? And so finally I was like, you know what? This just needs to be a book. And then other times people asked me to do stuff. So I wrote Live Like a Narnian because I was asked to speak at a conference. And so rushed that one through. That was fun. That was the most fun book I've ever written. Probably will be the most fun book because I was like in my late twenties, and it took like 6 weeks, and it was just like, lots
hose,
just exactly. I had students over to the house to like eat pizza, like $5 Little Caesars, hot and readies. And me read chapters where they give feedback. It was super fun.
Yeah.
So that one was a lot of fun, but because of that, then I got asked to write Lewis on the Christian Life because they're like, hey, this was really good. Would you do in this series on that? So that's how a lot of them. So, books are always churning. I've got book ideas kind of in the background when it comes to the article stuff. Basically, I'm just looking around going, what's a perennial issue? What's a thing that kind of comes up again and again and again? And that's just sort of simmering until strike while the iron's hot.
Right.
Other times it is much more occasional. It's that. And I often do these things in collaboration. So friends, we'll kick stuff around and all of a sudden I'll settle on that's the insight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now can I write 1,000 words on that will help clarify things for people. I think probably my burden when it comes to writing more than anything else is clarity. So it's just, I hate confusion more than I hate most things. And so when I see confusion, I'm like, no, we need to bring clarity to this. So try to see what are the actual issues involved and help people see it's this or that, this is the fundamental issue. Mm-hmm. That's kind of my key target.
Yeah. Awesome.
And you mentioned briefly at the beginning of this, the answer, the Bethlehem College.
Yeah.
So this is your first year at NSA teaching and you were out there, for a while. So, walk us through kind of how you ended up out here.
Sure. So yeah, I, went to seminary, at Bethlehem back in like 2005, and then happened to be there, providentially right place, right time. As they were expanding a seminary, the 2-year apprenticeship program, kind of like what Greyfriars is here, into a full seminary, and they were starting up a college program. And so I was just there at the ground floor and so began teaching in the college. And so I taught there for about 16 years. And the last two of that had been the president of the college and seminary. And then basically the part of the big reason for the move was what you might call like differences of approach to kind of culture, political philosophy, those kind of questions between me and certain leaders, not everyone there. So Bethlehem has a range of opinions, but I was as an out front leader, as the president of the school, the differences were, had become so substantial and weren't getting better. It wasn't the more conversations we had, the more distance we felt on questions like Christendom, questions about, you know, political philosophy and
so what you're saying is you doubled down.
It was basically, I think, in some ways I'd had many of those views for a long time, but I think the conversations in the wider culture about Christian nationalism and some of these sort of things sort of made them more live issues. And then it was like, as the details, what does that mean in terms of what you think is permissible or good or wise? As those questions were asked, it was like, oh, we're really actually far apart. And it's an area that I think is important. And that, others did too. So it was like, everybody, we all think this is important. What are we going to say about it? And sort of through that, that I kind of, you know, I have a degree from NSA, and have been friends with a lot of folks out here for many years. And so it became kind of clear that I think I fit better in terms, you know, build and fight, is what I want to do. And so, and really, so the, you know, rebuild the walls of Christendom, build and fight, that's, and that fit better here, even though there is a lot of similarities between sort of this, all of Christ for all of life mentality out here and, supremacy of God in all things at Bethlehem. But there's just kind of that different flavor. And so, and so I'm glad for that. I'm glad that Bethlehem's great. I'm so grateful for all my friends there and, you know, the Lord's going to bless that, I think, in terms of that different flavor. There's room on the wall for all sorts. But just for me, it was like, this is going to be a better fit. And I think that that's going to prove to be true.
And in terms of, I guess your, I mean, frankly, just have you had any, kind of theological or doctrinal developments like coming to Moscow or the kind of the transition period over, from Bethlehem?
So one of the things that occurred like late in the game, as I was, working through the stuff on sort of political philosophy, I'd been told for years, that you can't think the way that I was thinking about political philosophy and Reformed Protestant thought and be a Baptist.
Okay.
And I just kept thinking like, no, but I think I can, I think I am. And so, but towards sort of late in the game, it was like, well, maybe I better just double click on that. And so I took that issue off the shelf. So that wasn't, so it became an open question as I was leaving and coming out here, it wasn't necessary to sort it. But then kind of continuing to work through it, reading, you know, rereading some things, and kind of comparing, contrasting, that was kind of a another penny to drop. So that's like, that's probably the first actual theological shift that I've gone through since college. So in college is when I became Reformed. And basically everything else was, everything was set then.
So like, would you say kind of, I mean, like you already said, your mindset in terms of cultural engagement or, how you view Christendom, those sorts of things, like, were those set in college as well, or were those kind of
gradual? I mean, at least in early like 2007, 2008, so a few years out of college when I was starting to teach. So I was post-mill back then, and had all of that in the system. Christendom was on the radar. All of that was there, but it wasn't fully as worked out. You know, I've matured in the thinking, but the big structures were all there. And so the shift from credo baptism to paedo baptism now, was a kind of like actual, a shift. And so that is a development and would have prevented me from continuing on at Bethlehem as a Baptist, college and seminary.
And with you fitting in more with the, kind of build fight mentality, what would be your exhortation to other people in our community, other people with the same mindset, in the vein of, you know, sober mindedness, like we were talking about earlier, making sure that we're, keeping ourselves grounded in Christ, but at the same time, still fulfilling this, this role.
So, so I think one thing is, if the world's going to like their, you know, one of the things you see in the book of Acts, for example, is, the only people who are angry and losing their minds are the Sanhedrin and the mobs. The Christians are always under control, right? Paul knows what he's doing. He's preaching the gospel. He's looking for opportunities. He's as sober-minded as day and long. And yet things keep blowing up wherever he goes. Riots break out. Things happen, you know, either revivals or riots. Those are the options. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Not being reactive, not being led by our passions is fundamental, because you can't build well. You can't see clearly, and you won't build well if you aren't. So remaining tethered to Christ, I think this is where sort of the post-mill mindset is helpful, but it's not, maybe here's a way to put it. I think one of the more relevant questions on this is, everybody ought to be building and fighting regardless of your eschatology.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
even if you're not post-mill, the option isn't to give up everything and throw everything to the wind.
And you can think about it differently. So like for us, we're thinking, hey, we're rebuilding Christendom, just like Nehemiah rebuilt the walls of Jerusalem. So we're rebuilding Jerusalem, and we're doing so with the sword in one hand and a shovel in the other, because there's enemies who are going to harass us, and we've got a lot of work to do. But other people look at that and say, but hey, we're not America, Western civilization. We're not Israel.
Mm-hmm.
We're in Babylon, man. What are you talking about? We're in Babylon. We're exiles in Babylon. We're not rebuilding Jerusalem. And I just want to say, okay, that's fine. You want to run with that analogy? You want to run with that typology?
Mm-hmm.
I can work with that, because what Jeremiah wrote to the exiles in Babylon was like, build, like build houses, right. Build vineyards in that city, seek the good of that city. So build it. So whether you think you're building the walls of Jerusalem, or whether you're building little walls around your house and your garden, either way, building is the thing you're doing. And then fighting comes in, because either you're being harassed by the peoples of the land, like in Nehemiah, or you're Daniel, who you're praying for the good of the city. Mm-hmm. You're seeking the good of the city, just like Jeremiah told you to. And now here come these enemies who come and want to throw you in a lion's den. Or here come those folks who are going to accuse you, and you're going to get thrown in the fiery furnace. Right. So the fighting is going to be unavoidable. The resistance to idolatry and false worship is going to be unavoidable, and the building's unavoidable. So we should all agree we're going to build, and I'm perfectly happy, to let God, the results, leave those in God's hands. Totally. So let's just all build together, and then leave the results in God's hands.
Awesome. So this summer, you are going to be, the keynote speaker at the college conference.
I will.
Which
I
have done previously.
That's right. I think I'm
that was smooth, Joel. Good job.
There was a connection that I made earlier and I forgot.
Anyway, but college conference.
We're just going to do a really quick, a really kind of sharp.
Tell us about college conference, Dr. Yes.
Yeah. So I was the first speaker at college conference like about 6 years ago, I think.
Nice.
And back then, actually did my first time, we did Genesis 1-4, which is basically now a key part of those lordship lectures.
Okay.
So I basically use a bunch of that stuff that I was doing back then in the lordship class.
Yeah.
This summer, the topic that we've chosen is the two ways to live. And so the basic idea is Romans 1 is this kind of classic text on what's wrong with the world. It's the wrong way. So the wrath of God is revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, and they won't honor God as God and give thanks. And because of that, their sexuality is disordered, and, you know, they leave aside the natural use. And then because of that, all of the social dysfunction that results, the ruthless, faithless, heartless, disobedient to parents, malicious, envy, full of envy and rivalries and all this sort of stuff. So that passage works from vertical with God to sexuality, and then to social disaster.
Yeah.
That's one way. And so basically what I've done over the years is I take that passage and I just turn it on its head. Or put it up to a mirror and say, okay, what would the opposite be? What would the pleasure of God being revealed against all godliness and righteousness of men look like? What would if you did honor God as God, if you did give thanks, what then? And it's the reordering of our sexuality, and it's social harmony, cohesion. It's the kind of communities we want. So there's two ways to live. And so over the course of that week, or, you know, there's 2 weeks now because two different groups, I'm going to walk through those passages, that passage twice, once the bad way, and then once the good way, as a way of commending, this is the choice that faces all of us. And so this is what you ought to do.
Mm, awesome. And speaking of, well, here's a good segue, Joel. Yeah, youths go to called conference. And so then let's talk about your youth, Dr. Rigney.
Okay.
Yeah, before we go, I just wanted to ask you about your kind of upbringing and I guess your Christian testimony in the midst of that, and how you kind of got on this path of life here.
For sure. Yeah, I grew up in West Texas in a little town called Midland.
Okay.
And as I like to say, it's the place where God ran out of ideas. It's just the desert. It's just it's desert. If you like the sky, it's awesome. It's amazing. Big sky country, kind of like Montana. But you know, but I grew up there and was raised in a Christian home. I've got two younger brothers and grew up playing West Texas high school football. So Friday Night Lights was actually my high school.
Yeah,
we did that. That was the way we rolled. That book or whatever was written about our district.
Oh, wow.
So I grew up playing high school football and, played a lot of baseball, went off to Texas A&M, became a Christian, at the Baptist church there in town, when I was about 12, you know, kind of did the walk the aisle, thing, was baptized actually with my dad who had grown up nominally Catholic and then kind of steadily moved more towards, evangelicalism. But he and I were baptized in the same, service, which is really special in hindsight. And then, went off to college at, Texas A&M. And that's where I got into kind of Reformed theology. Piper's ministry was hugely influential on me, in those years, just opened up the Bible in ways that I had not even ever imagined. Yeah. And that's where I felt called to ministry. So I wanted to become pastor, and then went off to seminary where I kind of fell more in love with the classroom. And realized that, you know, so having one foot in the academy and one foot in the church is kind of where I like to live. So I joke that I'm a professor by day and I'm a pastor by night. That's actually a good mix. That's kind of where I like to live.
Yeah.
Because I think that those worlds need each other so that it's not all ivory tower and that it's actually substantive. Translating from one to the other is something that I really, really love doing.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the rough and ready. I also, just in terms of other personal stuff, met my wife at Texas A&M, and she moved up with me to Minnesota, like left, you know, hearth and home and, you know, country and kindred in Texas. And we moved up to Minnesota back in 2005. And we have three boys. Sam is 14, Peter is 12, and Jack is 5. And so they're here doing Logos, and my youngest is at Jubilee, here in town. So, they're having a big time too.
That's great.
That's awesome.
We've asked this to a number of different people outside of your work. What are your other hobbies?
Weird hobbies, Dr. Igney?
I don't have any. Well, okay. I probably do. But the things that I do just kind of for fun, honestly, is like, I love coaching. So I've coached my boys in baseball, up till now, in the fall, this last fall, I was an assistant coach on the Logos football team. And that was a blast, fulfilling a lifelong dream of a, you know, when I was in high school, like I wanted to be a football coach and now I'm doing it. It's great. So I love coaching and things like that. I like to read, and probably so like in terms of like the weird sort of stuff, I actually enjoy reading, certain like Star Wars novels. This is like super, it's stupid, but it's awesome.
You're a Star Wars novel kind of guy.
Always better than movies.
There's a character in like the extended whatever. I don't know. Like I'm not super into, but like there's one character, his name's Grand Admiral Thrawn. And I remember reading the books back when I was a kid.
The blue guy. Yeah.
I have no idea.
He's
the blue guy, Joel.
He's the blue guy, Joel. So I read those like back when I was like in college or high school, like when people were writing fan fiction about Star Wars, and I read them and really liked them. Well, then they like brought him back in like the new stuff. And like this, the guy
is canon now.
He's not. Yeah. They wrote like 6 novels about him. And like, I really like them and I read them. And I will reread them. When I'm looking for something to just detox, it's either that or Jane Austen.
All right. Now we have Dr. Igney on record saying he's a Star Wars fanfic enjoyer. So
I am.
Well, it's great. Well, Dr. Igney, thank you so much for coming on. This has been great.
Thank you very much.
Glad to be here.